This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Larry Berman. He's the biographer of Elmo Russell Bud Zumwalt Jr., one of the great warriors of any time, chief of naval operations, and a man responsible indirectly in the death of his son. We'll talk about the legacy of Admiral Zumwalt. Also, Raymond Strother, the political consultant from Louisiana, on the tightening of the presidential election 4 weeks from today. President Obama and Governor Romney are in a neck-and-neck battle for the White House. And Nancy Rabelais, LSU scientist, has received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in recognition of her work in advancing Louisiana's coast. All this today. First, the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 297-5633 locally. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest to begin our show is Larry Berman, perhaps the foremost historian on the Vietnam War. He's written four previous books on the war, and his latest is a biography about a man who was active in those times, Zumwalt, the life and times of Admiral Elmo Russell Bud Zumwalt, Jr., the charismatic chief of naval operations and the Navy's most popular leader since World War II, according to Time magazine. Good morning, Larry.
Well, good morning. Delighted to be here.
Why was Admiral Zumwalt so popular and effective?
Well, his popularity related directly to the fact that he had this concept of loyalty down. I mean, he was beloved by his sailors. Zumwalt often said that he had two long lists, one of friends and one of enemies, and he was equally proud of both of them because, of course, as he enacted all the changes that he wanted to, he did incur the wrath of a certain segment of the Navy and of certain politicians and the like. But his sailors loved him. He was known as a sailor's admiral. He cared about them, and he believed that a commander's responsibility did not end when the war was over and the battle was done. He actually believed a commander had a lifetime responsibility to his troops, and that was most evident some 20 or 25 years after Vietnam when he fought for his sailors with respect to getting compensation for their exposure to Agent Orange when they were in Vietnam.
Well, you mentioned Agent Orange, and that, of course, is probably the most searing thing about his legacy, the connection to his son.
Yes, you know, the whole, well, the Zumwalt family, again, for the listeners, is one that, you know, they have four generations of Bronze Stars. It is a family dedicated to the concept of service to the nation, and all of them have served. And young Elmo, his name is his firstborn son and his namesake, was no exception. He volunteered for duty in Vietnam. He wanted to prove himself in Vietnam. It was a very dangerous situation because his father was, in 1968, was head of naval forces in Vietnam, and here is his son wanting to command a swift boat, one of the most dangerous assignments, and imagine if he had gotten caught or something like that, and what a difficult situation it was. Elmo Jr. knew that his father, he didn't know, he hoped his father would not stop him from going to Vietnam, and his father did not, and Elmo served from 1968 to 1970. He was a swift boat commander. He was in some of the most treacherous areas of Vietnam, and then, of course, when Admiral Zumwalt, as a commander of the forces there, in order to protect his sailors, issued the order to defoliate the jungles. But before he gave that order to defoliate the jungles, he asked the Pentagon and he asked the chemical companies, was this Agent Orange, was this dioxin harmful to human beings? And he received numerous guarantees that it was not, it only harmed vegetation, and his sailors would be safe. So Elmo and a lot of other brave sailors returned home in 1970, 71, 72, having been exposed to Agent Orange, and little did they know they had a time bomb inside of them. And some 10 years after Elmo had returned, and he was practicing law in North Carolina. It was discovered that he had cancer that would eventually claim his life. And Admiral Zumwalt, his father, who had issued the order, this terrible irony that his own son had died by an order that he had issued to defoliate the jungles, his father, in one of the last things he promised his son, was that he would find accountability for who had lied to him, who had the information, and he would fight for all those who were still alive. Not only, by the way, sailors, but their children, many of whom were also affected by their father's exposure to Agent Orange. And for Zumwalt's work in 1998, that is why President Clinton gave him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, our nation's highest honor.
The book is Zumwalt, The Life and Times of Admiral Elmo Russell Bud Zumwalt, Jr., who was a veteran of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and a graduate of the United States Naval Academy at Annapolis. Quite a life. As you say, he cultivated many friends and an assortment of enemies, including Henry Kissinger.
Yes, Henry Kissinger. Actually, Admiral Zumwalt became quite an expert on Henry Kissinger. He practiced what he called Kissingerology, which was based on the premise that you could never believe what Henry Kissinger meant by what he said, and you had to decipher it the same way back in the period of the Cold War we would decipher the intentions of the Soviets, not by what they said, but by piecing together the puzzles of a jigsaw. He and Henry went right at it all the time, primarily over their view of the Soviet Union and the need for secrecy versus a public debate. Zumwalt was on the side of those people who believed, and by the way, Kissinger and Zumwalt both did agree that the Soviet Union was a threat, but Kissinger believed that the issue was so important that it had to be kept secret, and that everything the United States had to do had to be kept below the surface, because it's not frighten people literally, but also to try to achieve their ends. Whereas Zumwalt believed quite strongly, and that the issue was so important it had to be taken publicly, and that this should be reflected in defense budgets and the like. And these two men clashed. They spied on each other. I have a chapter in the book, as you know, Zumwalt's Intelligence Service, which documents the extent to which Zumwalt himself placed his own loyal Navy men in Kissinger's shop, and they were regularly reporting back to him on Henry's trips and travels, and often Zumwalt knew where Kissinger was going before Kissinger even knew where he was going, thanks to his loyal aides. And, of course, it was President Nixon in 1972 when these incidents at sea occurred, which threatened to actually end Zumwalt's tenure, in which Nixon actually told Kissinger to fire Zumwalt, but Kissinger never followed that order up, and neither did Nixon. These two men clashed all the time.
Why didn't he get fired?
Well, first of all, he did not get fired because only Richard Nixon had the authority to fire him. Henry Kissinger, who was at that time was not Secretary of State but was the head of the National Security Council, did not have the statutory responsibility. And Zumwalt had already decided, had Kissinger done that, that he would have ignored it and said, I want to hear it from Nixon. And the fact is that Nixon was already preoccupied by other matters, but Nixon could hardly afford to fire someone who was privy to the inner secrets of his own administration. So, like a lot of things Nixon did, he said, "Fire! I want Zumwalt fired." He told Kissinger to do it, but probably deep down, when it didn't happen, he probably didn't mean it when he said it. It was just the way he felt at the time.
Now, Zumwalt, of course, went straight to war after graduating from Annapolis, but he came home from the war with a bride.
Well, it's a wonderful story. It's a love affair for, you know, some 50 some odd years. That's right. He met Musa, his wife, during the very last days of the war, when he was made a prize crew captain, he entered the Yangtze River right during the last days of World War II. He was invited to a home to celebrate the fact that the American forces had liberated this area, and there he met them. what he described in a letter home to his father, the most beautiful and most captivating woman of his life. She spoke very little English. He spoke almost no Russian, but he connived and figured out a way to spend time with her. And after a whirlwind romance of 10 days, he married her with the Robinson crew in attendance. And one of the things I learned in writing the book is how important Musa was to Bud Zumwalt's career. You know, she became a literally, you know, he had spent 14 years at sea. So not only did she raise four children, a family by herself so often, but she was house mother to sailors' wives. She represented the admiral in so many different functions. And indeed, they're both buried next to one another at the U.S. Naval Academy. And there is only one word on Admiral Bud Zumwalt's tombstone, and that is reformer, which I think captures his life. And on his wife's tombstone, it says his strength, which I think also captures her wonderful role in his life.
What did the admiral think of the outcome in Vietnam?
Well, in the book, and that's a great question. In the book, I did have the chance to get to know Admiral Zumwalt as well as writing this biography. But he was on record as saying he wished we had never fought in Vietnam. But he was most upset about the way we fought in Vietnam, which was that if a decision was made to fight a war as Vietnam, well, it wasn't really a declared war, but he didn't agree with the way the way political pressure was brought to fight a war by dribbling in troops with unclear objectives, and he favored very early in the war, 1961, 62, 63, taking the kinds of measures which would have stopped the communists at that very early period. By 1966, 67, he was actually in favor of ending the war in Vietnam. He believed it was a stalemate. He was greatly influenced by his own mentor, Paul Nitze. And by 1969 and 70, he was preparing the U.S. Navy for its withdrawal well before President Nixon announced a policy of Vietnamization. But the one other lesson he always took about away from Vietnam, and I think this is really important, which is the bravery of his sailors and the courage of all those who served, and he learned so much from them. And this is one of the reasons when he became CNO, which was in 1970, Chief of Naval Operations, you know, and he was known as the CNO who lets sailors grow their hair long and have beards and ride motorcycles and basically getting rid of all that Mickey Mouse regulations. He said he learned that all in Vietnam, because here were these soldiers who were fighting for their country. They knew patriotism. They understood what their mission was, and the length of their hair, whether they rode motorcycles, whether or not they were allowed to drink beer in the barracks, had nothing to do with the most central issue, which was their heroism, their bravery, and their character. And so when he left Vietnam and became Chief of Naval Operations, he always said, I learned from my sailors that this stuff had nothing to do with their performance in battle, and it was very important for the Navy to reflect. Zumwalt felt, there were many critics who disagreed, that the Navy needed to better represent society so that it could draw from the full picture of society.
Zumwalt was born in 1920, San Francisco, to two doctors. How does a young man like that end up being the most charismatic military leader of his time?
Yeah, I thought about that question a lot. Where did this come from? And I think it comes from, I found a letter that his, as Bud Zumwalt was dying just 2 days into the new century in January of 2000, his wife wrote a letter that you've read because it's in the book, that was read at the Renaissance gathering that he was very fond of going to in Hilton Head. And his wife tried to explain it, and what Musa said was that he had suffered so many losses and tragedies so young that he used that to try to help others later in life. You know, he was the son of two doctors. His mother died at a very young age of breast cancer. He lost his younger brother from a terrible disease at a
We'll be back to wrap it up with Larry Berman, the author of Zumwalt, The Life and Times of Admiral Elmo Russell, Bud Zumwalt, Jr. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Larry Berman, one of the top biographers of Vietnam. Among his previous works, Lyndon Johnson's War, The Road to Stalemate in Vietnam, and No Peace, No Honor, Nixon, Kissinger, and A Betrayal in Vietnam. Larry's pen taken a turn with a biography about Admiral Elmo Russell Bud Zumwalt, Jr. And Randy and Zachary, please be brief. You're on the air with Larry Berman.
Hi there. I've just noticed there's a vast contrast between two gentlemen, Ernest King and Admiral Zumwalt. Thanks.
Ernest King?
I didn't hear the. I heard the name Ernie King, who was an admiral and a peer of Bud Zumwalt and a friend. But I didn't hear the question.
He asked about the contrast.
Well, I think the contrast was really day and night, particularly in Vietnam. And King replaced Zumwalt in Vietnam, and when Zumwalt became CNO. But I believe the two men were good friends, that they respected each other, but they had two different concepts of leadership, particularly with respect to this concept of loyalty down. And there was a big difference between the way Admiral King worked with the Vietnamese and Tran Van Chon compared to Admiral Zumwalt. Having said that, both men had distinguished naval careers, and both were extremely honorable men.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Professor Larry Berman, who has had an outstanding career in academia, and including his remarkable writing. He is Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Davis, and the founding dean of the Honors College at Georgia State, and he has joined us today from Atlanta. Thank you, Larry.
My pleasure. Thank
Take
you.
Take care. 297-5633, your number outside our area. It is 877-217-5757. We're joined by Ray Strother, the well-known political consultant who's handled candidates near and far, including Bill Clinton and Gary Hart, Lloyd Benson. Good morning, Raymond Strother from Bozeman, Montana.
Good morning.
Well, the presidential race appears to be tightening.
It really is. I was looking at polls this morning. You know, you have to look at polls with a jaundiced eye. You have to understand what they're trying to tell you. But I don't think there's any doubt at all that Romney is at worst tied, at best a point, 2 points, 3 points ahead as of this morning, looking at the accumulation of the poll averages from last night.
How do you explain this? A week ago, people were saying the race was over.
Well, there's always some fluidity in the race, and the debate performance for President Obama was so poor, and Romney looked so good. He didn't look like a frightening man anymore. He looked like a reasonable human being, and he swung way back to the middle and became a moderate. And all of a sudden, as a moderate, he wasn't terribly frightening. America really isn't right. America really isn't left. America's right in the middle. And so he had to move back to the middle for people to take him seriously. And he moved seriously back to the middle.
But in the debate, he must have shown the American people, at least that small percentage of undecided voters, that he was capable.
Yeah, capable and not a crazy, not a right-wing crazy. Which a lot of people were worried about. It was a masterful performance. There's no question about that. I watched that as a loyal liberal Democrat. I watched that with much dread and gloom by the time it was over.
Well, what happened to the president? He's a well-spoken man. He makes his case better than anyone else, but many say the last week he didn't do that.
Well, you know, I don't know the president. It's one of the politicians I've never even met. But it seems to me that he was, and I hate to use this word, but he seemed a little arrogant. He was so far ahead in the polls before that, I didn't think there was any way he could be defeated, to be honest with you. He was at least 5 solid points ahead. He was, on September the 30th, it was 49-45, and and since then, it's been moving forward, so that today it's the average is 47-47. And I think he took too much for granted, and I don't think they took the debate preparation seriously. I don't think they took Romney seriously, and it was a terrible mistake. They made a calculated error.
Ray, there are two presidential debates to go and one vice presidential debate. Could the outcome of these debates have an effect on what happens 4 weeks from tonight?
You know what's strange, Jim, is I'm one of those who always thought that debates really had no effect on election. I held that pretty strongly at one time. But in this presidential election, it seems debates are of great importance because there's been so much negative advertising around. You don't see it in Louisiana because you're not a target state. You don't count like I don't see it in Montana. But as I travel and I go to states that aren't taken for granted, like Ohio or Michigan, you're just overwhelmed with ads, just one after the other, most of them negative from both sides. So the debate was somehow it cleared the fog so people could see the candidates and make their own decisions without the prejudice of television spots or negative advertising. And I think that all of a sudden the debate, because of the confusion in the on the airways, was a clarification to people. That's all I can think. For example, the most interesting thing out of the Pew poll I was looking at was some depth today. Pew poll shows women now tied with Romney and the president tied with women voters. And 10 days ago, the president had about a 15-point lead among women. And I found that startling that moved so quickly. Romney was a little frightening to women because of the Republicans and all their personal issues, all the social issues they seem to espouse. But that debate wasn't about social issues. It was about economic issues. It was about leadership. It was about other things. And I think women all of a sudden weren't frightened by Romney anymore. They looked and said, not bad. And I think that's what happened.
297-5633 for Ray Strother, the well-known political consultant, Dr. Ray Strother, who received his Ph.D. from Northwestern State University, where he still teaches in Natchitoches. If you'd like to reach us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Now, Governor Romney last week made his case that funding for public broadcasting should be discontinued by the government, $445 million a year, including $69 million for public radio. That's well under 0.1% of the federal budget. Do we have the cut from Governor Romney, Kevin? Let's give it a listen.
I'm sorry, Jim. I'm going to stop the subsidy to PBS. I'm going to stop other things. I like PBS. I love Big Bird. I actually like you, too. But I'm not going to keep on spending money on things to borrow money from China to pay for it.
All right. He's talking about Jim Lehrer, not yours truly. But what do you think, Raymond Strother?
Well, I think that was in the debate. That's probably the only error he made, because it did seem a little radical to take such a tiny slice of the pie, I mean, infinitesimal part of the budget, and say you're going to kill a program that educated people really appreciate. And educated people, he had a lot of voters in that group of educated people and upper-income people. And he disappointed a lot of them with that. I think they're going to hear about Big Bird more and more, not as because of Big Bird, but simply because of what it represents. It represents a little, it shows a little bit of the radicalism. A little radicalism was poking through there. And I think he'll probably be sorry he said that, because that wasn't moderate. That wasn't moderate at all. I understand today the campaign, the Democrats have put an ad on featuring Big Bird, so they know it's important, too, to some of his base.
Monday at the Baton Rouge Press Club, the three candidates for the 6th District seat were on hand to debate, including the incumbent, the Republican Bill Cassidy, along with the Libertarian Rufus Craig and Independent Richard Torrigano, all of whom have been on our show of late. Now, Congressman Cassidy dug in his heels on this funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Here's what he said regarding this.
Public broadcasting is obviously part of the fabric of our communication. On the other hand, I think Governor Romney had a good point. Right now, when I was elected 4 years ago, we borrowed 39 cents of every dollar that we spent. Then it went to 40. Then it went to 41. Now it's 42 cents of every dollar we spend, we borrow. And when you ask senior citizens or people on Medicaid, listen, these are tough times, they say, yes, but what about this and what about that? In fact, when you talk to taxpayers and you say, listen, you may have to pay more taxes according to some people's plan, they say, well, is there anything we cut out? Now, granted, the federal government doesn't spend that much on Corporation of Public Broadcasting relative to how much their budget is. But think about it. I like to think about it in taxpayer units. If the average taxpayer pays $10,000, how many average taxpayers would it take to make that much? As long as we are going in the wrong direction in the amount of money we're borrowing, I think we have to take a serious look even at things as valuable as public broadcasting.
All right, that's Congressman Cassidy, who is touting the party line. I don't know that he's going to have any trouble being reelected. He's got $1.8 million in his campaign war chest, and his challengers don't have $5,000 between them. But this sentiment is something that is consistent with the Republicans on Capitol Hill, raced rather.
Yeah, well, they've always been any public radio, television, et cetera, public broadcasting, because they say it's a liberal institution. I don't see that. I've had conservatives sit down with me, and I've asked them, explain to me, put a red flag up or grab my arm when you think it's turned liberal. And you watch a newscast. It's just something they've been taught. But I thought it was interesting about how many taxpayers it would take to pay for Big Bird. But somehow I saw a calculation the other day. That's about 3 hours of military spending. What they give public broadcasting, 3 or 4 hours of military spending. Why can't we look at it that way? There are some cuts that need to be made, and perhaps we need to not spend more money than all the countries on Earth put together on military. rather than crush part of the cultural fabric of the country, like public broadcast.
No.
Why not cut back on 2 or 3 colonels?
Adam in Beauregard Town says, is this an assault on the arts? Is there a lack of respect for artistic endeavors by some members of Congress?
Absolutely, it's an assault on the arts. And you have to look right down to local school boards. I always use Texas as the worst possible model. They're trying to do away with most art courses. If you're an artist, it makes you liberal. So they're trying to do away with art courses, art history, a lot of things that really contribute to America and to education. And, you know, when you teach college students, when you run into college students, as I did at Harvard, that had been better grounded in the arts and had come from schools, a lot of them prep schools, had come from schools where they had studied the arts and participated in music and et cetera. Those are better students. They're better rounded students. They understand, they have a better understanding of things, and they have a more flexible mind. So I don't understand this fight against the arts. They've tried to put everything in political terms. I'm turning liberal on you now, right now. But seems like the right wing's tried to cast everything in some political term, and I don't see art being political. Art is an expression, and people have fought for the right of free expression since the beginning of time, and I just hate to see it dampened.
Andrew on Highland. Andrew, you're on the air with Raymond Strother.
You know, I really think it's time to have a conversation about cuts. And you look at Big Bird, Children's Television Network, Sesame Street, how much money do they make? Does anyone ever ask? How much money could they contribute towards public television and public radio? No one ever talks about that. They just said, well, the government ought to pay for it. And that's where I think we're wrong. We need to look at the whole picture. They make a lot of money off of they got to start with public television. And why don't we look to see how much they contribute? That's all right.
Well, I think we do know the figures. We do know how much income the public broadcasting has, and we know what the government contribution is. Government contribution is not a huge slice of.
No, for example, this radio station, less than 15% of the funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The rest comes from private entities, from listeners and members and underwriters. And so the coffers are not swimming with public money in public broadcasting.
Also, the merchandising that they do on Big Bird and Sesame Street dolls, et cetera, goes back into public broadcasting. So what the gentleman was saying probably has some merit, but I think it doesn't pay attention to the fact that it's very little public money, and we do know where their money comes from. We do know where it goes. So I don't think that's a good argument.
Well, there is a perception by some, and I think it's an incorrect one, but that public broadcasting is the liberal left hangout equivalent to Fox News on the right. What do you think of that perception?
I think that is completely wrong, 180 degrees wrong. MSNBC would be the liberal hangout, not public broadcasting. If you have an opportunity, and I'm in Montana where there's so many ranchers and farmers and they're so terribly conservative, very bright but very conservative, have them sit with you through a public broadcast and then have them punch you, as I said before, punch you when something is overtly liberal and not objective. Now, they may not agree with what the facts are, but disagreeing with the facts and a liberal bias are completely different things. So I just can't agree with that. I know that's what's said. I know they don't like it when people report on things that their conservative idols do. But, you know, fact is fact, and I'm a great defender of journalism. We're not journalists. We wouldn't have America anyway. We'd be more like China.
Well, the story has legs. If Governor Romney wins the presidency and the Republicans win the House and the Senate, then I would think that funding for public broadcasting could be in peril. And if that happens, then should public stations be allowed to play commercials unabated like every other station on the dial? Is that a fair trade-off, Ray Strother?
I'd hate to see it because not having commercials gives them a certain freedom that they wouldn't have. And also, isn't it lovely to sit and watch the nightly news and it's for an hour, not interrupted, a full hour of information instead of a 20-second story that you get on NBC? You sometimes have a 4- and 5-minute story where you can cover both sides better and you can get a better perspective. I would hate to see that happen. But that's not the only place. If the extreme right wing takes over this country, that's not the only place we're going to be injured or hurt, culturally, educationally, politically. I would call that the beginning of the political dark ages for America.
Kevin, let's hear Rufus Craig, who is the Libertarian candidate in the race against Congressman Cassidy. He, along with Richard Torrigano, voiced support for public broadcasting.
You know, I'm a big fan of public radio and public TV. The truth is, I don't think my radio ever goes anyplace but the public radio station. Public funding for radio is important, as I appreciate it, because it makes up 10-15% of the budget. I think if the great people that put public radio on the air, they need to be aware of the fact that the possibility is looming that that source of funding may be evaporating, in which case it would be, for me and all the other listeners, I would hope that we're looking to find other sources of funding to keep those great programs on the air.
Now, this is not going to happen, most likely, unless the Republican leadership is in the majority in both the House and the Senate. How do you see the Senate right now, Raymond Strother?
Well, I think the Senate will remain probably in Democratic hands. It depends on a couple of states. It depends on Massachusetts if Brown gets defeated, and he's at the moment a little behind. Although the undertow from Obama sinking may hurt him, although Obama will carry that state huge, it may hurt him a point, or it may hurt her a point or two. I think the Senate will stay about the same as it is, and I think the House will maybe go Democratic by 4, 5, 6 seats. But
all right, hold tight. 297-5633. We'll be back with Ray Strother after this 1 minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Bit more time with Ray Strother, the well-known political consultant who has handled candidates in Louisiana and the nation for several decades. Amy on Starring Lane. Hi, Amy. You're on with Ray Strother.
Hi. I am a big fan of your show. I'm a big fan of public radio, and I just wanted to get in on the conversation about public funding of the arts. I'm actually a musician myself. And I love public radio, but I think that the arts, personally, as a musician, I want to be self-funded. I want to be self-supported. And I think the community also needs to get involved more in supporting the arts, and especially, you know, financially. If we had more of a supportive community for the arts, we might not need, you know, grants and programs that are from the government, because I think there's other things that the government needs to be spending our money on.
Well, you know, that Jim, that's a very rational Republican idea. But I remember a few years ago when there was an active attempt during the Bush administration to cut public broadcasting. The Republicans are the ones who backed up and said, ooh, I didn't realize it was such a touchy subject, because their own constituents stopped the movement to kill public broadcasting. So it's not a foregone conclusion that even Romney could kill public broadcasting, because the senators are going to look home and say, or the House members say, oh, maybe we better not go that far. But you were asking about the Senate. While we went on break, I'm looking at a Senate map right now. And according to Real Clear Politics, if the election were held today, it'd be 46 Democrats in the Senate and 43 Republicans, a three-seat advantage. And there are 11 toss-ups. So the Senate's far from decided yet.
And what did you say about the House?
I don't know about the House. I haven't looked at the House. I'm just looking at the Senate right now. But it's far from decided who will control the Senate right now. It's 46-43 right now, Democrats. But there are a lot of toss-up states that we don't know.
And there's some surprising toss-ups. For example, Linda McMahon, the wife of Vince McMahon, the wrestling promoter, is in a neck-and-neck race in Connecticut, of all places. Big wrestling state, by the way. For the U.S. Senate, that's a bit of a surprise.
Well, the other one surprised to me is Nebraska. Bob Kerry, one of the great politicians of our era, Medal of Honor winner, et cetera, senator for a long time from Nebraska, went to head, I think, NYU or New York City University. I don't remember
which
one. To
New College.
New College, is that it? Okay, now he's back and running for the Senate, and he's being defeated. That's going to move to into the Republican ranks, Nebraska will. Montana is a toss-up. We have a very tight race here. And that may end up being Democratic. So there are a few, like the Brown race in Massachusetts. It may end up going Democratic. So the Democrats could pick up a few seats. But right now, I wouldn't bet on either side.
Okay. Few other questions for Ray Strother that I'll pose to him via email, but you may also reach us in our remaining time with him, 297-5633. Getting back to Amy's remarks, study after study has shown that funding of the arts results in money that grows the economy. And there's a question from Leonard Joseph. He says, does Governor Romney see the value of seed money and how it grows? And he points to Steve Jobs and the study of calligraphy as being a part of Mr. Jobs' endeavors. What do you think, Raymond Strother?
Well, I think it's very important. I live in a small town. It's 17,000. The county is probably 40,000. And we have both an opera and a symphony here. And it's all privately funded, of course. A lot of money spent, a lot of time spent on raising money. But the real estate people say, and the business people say, it would be harder to bring people to town without a symphony. It'd be harder to sell this as a place where you'd want to settle with your family or start a business without a symphony. So I think the arts play a more important part in our life than we give credit. And it's a shame that the arts are being caught in a political fight.
Question, it's an interesting one from Joan about the debate, saying that Governor Romney looked good and that has something to do with his surge in popularity. You saw somewhat the same thing when you were handling Gary Hart. It doesn't hurt to have a telegenic candidate, does it?
No, remember, that people make their final vote's emotional. They don't sit down with a pad and put two columns and say, okay, this candidate believes this, candidate B believes that. They end up making an emotional decision right at the end. And looks really matter. For example, we know that people over 6 feet get elected president. I mean, that's just a fact. It just goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. Most of our presidents are over 6 feet tall, even in a time when people were shorter because of nutrition, et cetera. So appearance really matters. Style really matters. This impression of how this person reacts to me really matters. For example, the most important question in a poll might be the one that says, cares about people like me. And that's how decisions are made, more than where they stand on, you know, individual topics. It would be appearance, demeanor. Obama looked like he didn't care. He looked lackadaisical. He just wasn't there. And Romney looked engaged. He looked vibrant. He looked reasonable. Mm-hmm. And those things really matter. Those things add up. And I doubt anybody can tell you what Romney said in the debate. I seriously doubt it, except for Big Bird, which was, he stood out. But I don't think they could remember what he said. But I think they instinctively remember how he looked and the feel they got from him.
Well, your former client, Gary Hart, by the way, says he will be on the show sometime in the next week or two. So
Great man. The great wasted resource of America was Gary Hart. He's one of the smartest, best men I've ever represented. And I still am very sad the fact that he wasn't president of the United States.
Final call for Ray Strother, Joseph in New Iberia. Joseph, you're on the air with Ray.
Ray, I am a conservative, but I do contribute as much as I can to public TV because I listen to you all the time. But my opinion of today's program is it's 90% against Romney's idea of defunding public service TV, and I think it ought to be both ways, even though you are employed by public TV, and that's one of the oppositions that conservatives have, that you don't give a full coverage of both sides of the argument.
All right.
Correction, I'm not employed by anyone. I'm retired and have never been employed by public broadcast. I'm more talking about as a news consumer and as a patron of the arts. It has nothing to do with employment. I think it's much deeper than that. I've never made 10 cents off of anything, and Jim Inkster is not going to send me a check for doing this today. I feel this is very serious. I know we have spent a lot of time on this, but it was it's an interesting conversation because it deals with more than just politics. It deals with where we think art and news plays a part in our lives and where we get our information. You know, if we only had Fox News, my God, this would be an awful place to live, in my opinion. It would just be a terrible place. We'd never know what's going on.
All right. Well, I hope Joseph listens on a daily basis because we have people of all political stripes on this show.
Sure.
And the two people we heard from other than Ray, Mitt Romney and Bill Cassidy, they both expressed opposition to funding for public broadcasting. And Congressman Cassidy, by the way, to his credit, showed up yesterday to a debate of three candidates, and he had nothing to really gain by being there, but he did show up, which is to his credit, and he says he will show up on the 26th on this show. So we will ask him at that time about this issue, just as we've asked Raymond Strother today, and I don't think anybody who listens to this program on a continuous basis would say the show is slanted one way or the other.
Absolutely not. Civil discourse is very important, and people can have legitimate differences of opinion, even about public broadcasting, and not be terrible people or the forces of darkness. So no, this show is good at that, and I listen to it whenever I'm in that area and whenever I can. Sometimes online, and it contributes a great deal. This is why we can't get rid of shows like this.
Well, thank you, sir. And I might add that not all conservatives are opposed to public broadcasting, and
not all
liberals are in favor. For example, Billy Tozan, who's a conservative, he is a huge backer of public broadcasting.
He's a great intellect, too, incidentally. I'm a great, great admirer of Billy Tozan, and I did his first race for Congress when he was a Democrat and did some more races for him when he was a Democrat. I'm his biggest admirer, and I've always admired the fact that he did have an open mind about a lot of things.
Well, Ray Strother, it's always a delight to talk with you, sir.
Thank you.
Take care. Dr. Ray Strother joining us from Bozeman, Montana. And we're joined now by Nancy Rabelais, an LSU scientist who's received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in recognition for her work in advancing the preservation of Louisiana's coast. Good morning, Dr. Rabelais.
Hi, Jim. Nice to be
and
here.
You're joining us from beautiful Cocodrie, I understand.
Cocodrie, Louisiana, and as soon as I'm off the phone, I'll be jumping on a boat and going out into the field.
What will you be doing on the boat?
Well, this is related to our BP oil spill research, so it's not the hypoxia or dead zone research that the award was for, but it still gets me out on the water in a beautiful day.
Well, the MacArthur Foundation awards are heady stuff, and how did you find out that you were a recipient, Nancy?
I was at a meeting in Mexico and received a phone call, and the person on the other end asked me if I was alone, and I said no, and he said, could you go someplace private, and then started asking fairly circuitous questions, and finally got around to naming my birthday, and do you know anybody that was born on that day? So it was quite a surprise. I get calls like that often because they're looking for me to help find people to nominate. But so I just was not expected at all.
Well, this is a $500,000, no strings attached, support over 5 years. How will you use the money?
Well, I'll be putting it back into my research. It'll go into some funds that I'll have access to that I can use to support students or extra travel or equipment that I wouldn't be able to afford from my federal research grants, which are going down considerably given the state of the federal government.
Well, the money will be used for Nancy's research, and much of your influence or emphasis has been on hypoxia. Tell us about the oxygen depletion that you have found in the waters around our state.
Okay. The hypoxia just basically means low oxygen. Some people call them dead zones. I try not to do that too much because not everything is dead. But it's an area in the offshore Gulf of Mexico that doesn't have enough oxygen to support fish and shrimp and crabs the way we would normally think they could live. And they have to flee the area, and the animals that can't flee eventually die off if the oxygen stays low too long. So we started this in 1985, and we had our 28th anniversary cruise this last summer, and hopefully we'll get to keep going along for many years as I can be around to do it.
So 28 years. Now, in that time, have there been advancements, as far as the research and dealing with hypoxia?
Yes, I think we understand the processes a whole lot better now, both the physics and the biology. We've made very strong linkages with what happens in the watershed with regard to nitrogen and phosphorus runoff into the Gulf of Mexico. We've got much better idea on the processes, just the biology and how the nitrogen flows through the system. We haven't made as great a progress in engaging people to try to do something about it, but that's what we work at very hard, and we're getting there. We've got a lot of people in the watershed who are interested in sustainable agriculture and keeping the nutrients on the land, and also better conserving their land so that they don't have problems up there as well.
Nancy Rabelais, a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in recognition for her work advancing the preservation of the state's coast. What are the biggest impediments to preserving the coast?
Well, we have a long-term history of neglect, I would call it, and unintentional consequences, bad decisions, not just with the low oxygen offshore, but with coastal land loss. And so we can't expect an overnight fix, and it takes money, and it takes social will, and it takes political will, both in the Gulf of Mexico and in the watershed. So it's changing people's minds about how they live and how they do business and how they treat the environment. It's not an uphill battle, but it's a long road.
Now, the School of the Coast and Environment at LSU, it's a spectacular building. You can't miss it if you're over by the baseball stadium or near Tiger Stadium. What kind of work is it doing to address the issues that are so near and dear to you and to the rest of us?
Right. Well, the School of the Coast Environment has a Department of Oceanography and Coastal Sciences. I'm actually an employee of LUMCON, the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. But we work very closely with our LSU colleagues and other universities in the state. And of course, the focus is, as their name says, oceanography and coastal sciences. So I work with a lot of the faculty there who are on the hypoxia projects and have been for a long time, two of them from the very beginning in 1985. And this award is named for, you know, given to me, but it's basically a result of all the work of a lot of hard people.
Have you been affected by budget cuts?
Oh, definitely. The state budget for LUMCON is about a third of what it was 4 years ago, and that makes it difficult to keep doing all the unique things we do down here, marine education, research. We provide a marine laboratory on the coast, which doesn't exist otherwise for academics here. So, yes, it's been difficult. Our NOAA award for year four this year has been cut by 43%, and that makes it difficult to keep doing the work we're doing. So, yes, we're definitely in the throes of response to budget cuts right now.
Well, congratulations on your grant, and I know it will go to good use. Thank you, Nancy Rabelais.
Thank you very much, Jim.
One of the top marine ecologists in the world, based right here in Baton Rouge, and she is director of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.